You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to our conversation this afternoon on how to deliver health care and control costs. Americans pay more for their health care than residents of many other countries, but we get worse results. And people often assume that it has to be that way and it's always going to be the case. Yet in a new book that was just published by Brookings Institution Press, Bill Hazeltine argues that there are alternative models for organizing and financing healthcare. In his new book, Affordable Excellence, The Singapore Healthcare Story, he notes that Singapore ranks sixth in the world in healthcare outcomes, well ahead of many developed countries, yet it spends significantly less than many high-income nations. Even more remarkably, Singapore achieves these results at less than one quarter of the cost of healthcare that we pay in the United States and about half that of Western European countries. So we put together this forum in order to learn how Singapore does this and what are the lessons for the United States. And for those of you who are interested, right outside the auditorium, the Brookings Press is selling the book. So afterwards, you can feel free to get a copy, and I'm sure Bill would be happy to give you an autograph as well. Bill Hazeltine is chairman and president of Access Health International, Incorporated. This is an organization dedicated to promoting access to high-quality, affordable health care around the world. Bill was a noted former professor at Harvard Medical School and also the Harvard School of Public Health. He is well known for his pioneering work on cancer, HIV, AIDS, and genomics. He's authored more than 200 manuscripts in peer-reviewed journals and is the author of several books. He's the founder of Human Genome Sciences and served as chairman and CEO of that company until 2004. He also founded several other successful biotechnology companies. He's the president of the William A. Hazeltine Foundation for Medical Sciences and the Arts. So, Bill, let's just jump into the conversation. You wrote that Singapore ranks sixth in healthcare outcomes, but yet spends less proportionally than many other high-income systems. So if you could just start just by describing the Singapore healthcare system. How does it operate? How does it work to deliver healthcare?
Well, thank you very much, Harold. And let me begin by thanking Brookings. First of all, I've been on the board of Brookings for many years, and it's been a wonderful educational experience. In fact, this book grew out of a very early report that was done by Brookings called, by a rather provocative title, Restoring Physical Sanity. And what I realized from that report is something we all realize today, but this was prescient, is that healthcare costs are eating into every aspect of American life. Whether it's our productivity, whether it's our military, whether it's our foreign policy, whether it's Social Security, the healthcare costs are becoming so big, and the projections, if things stayed on track, were so disastrous that we had to do something different. And that's really the origin of the foundation, to go look around the world for best healthcare systems, for best ways to finance it, the best ways to manage it, best systems you can use, the best processes. And can we, rather than degrading our system by control when we control costs, make it more efficient? And that's really the origin of the book. And so as we looked around the world, one place that really stood out was Singapore. And then the support that I've gotten here at Brookings. Bob Faraday's in the back. He's the publisher, the esteemed publisher of the Brookings Press. Been extremely helpful. The whole staff has been very helpful. So I want to begin by that big thank you. But Singapore is unique. As anybody who's gone to Singapore knows, it's unique in a number of ways. It's a place that really works, and so you shouldn't be surprised that healthcare really works as well. But how does it work? How does it achieve what it does? This book is a very detailed study of the history, how it works, and really importantly, how they're looking forward to a problem we all face, which is how to take care of our aging population. That's what this book really does. And it's written not just for the United States. The purpose of our foundation is to help people, no matter where they are, have access to affordable health. So in this country, there's some valuable lessons. We are not going to be Singapore. We're too big. We're too complicated. We have too long a history of what we're doing. But there are lessons there that we can get to. But there are other countries that are just beginning to put in their healthcare systems. And the book is written for those countries as well, because as you begin, so you go. And it's very hard to reverse yourself, something that Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore understood very deeply very early on, and it's why they were able to build their healthcare system. But just to recapitulate you something you said, Daryl, Singapore does remarkably well in healthcare. They're in the top 10 and usually the top 5 in almost any measure of outcome, and yet they spend substantially less. As Daryl said, they spend less than one quarter of what we do. And is it that they're small? How do they do it? As a scientist, I'm interested in the fact that it can be done. It's what we call proof of principle. If it can be done somewhere, it can be done elsewhere. And my belief is that if Singaporeans can do it, other countries can do it. You can do a lot better than we do. And we have to do a lot better.
So you mentioned this proof of the concept. So tell us, how do they deliver the healthcare and how do they control the costs?
Well, the system that the Singaporeans have is basically they have a public-private system in which tertiary hospital care, multi-specialty care, is done mostly in public hospitals, about 80%. About 20% is private. You can have completely private options if you want. And that primary care is primarily done by private physicians, about 80-20, so it reverses. And they focus for a long time. Their first focus is they move from a third world to a first world economy, in the words of their president, Lee Kuan Yew, was to focus on public health and public clinics. But when they got richer, they started building a series of hospitals. And they had a very clear idea of how they should pay for it. The idea really came from a negative experience Lee Kuan Yew had in England. He writes in his biographies that he was astounded that he got free medical care. Every time he broke his glasses, they would give him a new set of glasses for free. He said, there's no incentive for anybody to take care of the medical system. You can't give people things for free and not have them abuse it. And the whole Singaporean system, in fact, is based on suspicion of economic man. They believe that we will cheat and chisel, believe it or not, if given the opportunity. And therefore, they built a system that most people have to pay. At the other hand, they had another philosophy, which is an important philosophy, I think, for Asia in particular, is social harmony. You can't get things too far out of balance. If you do, you'll have social disruption. And so by balancing the idea that you have to make people pay with the idea of social harmony, that is making it possible for them to pay, they came up with what was a reasonably unique solution. And we would call it a mandatory 401k. That is, you are obliged to save money. Your employer puts in 16% today. You put in 20%. It's your money. It's tax deductible. And a portion can be used for retirement, solving a major problem we're about to address, retirement. Another chunk can be used for housing and is used for housing. As a result of that provision, 85% of Singaporeans own their own house, which means a socially stable situation. And another part of it can be used for your health, your own health, your parents' health, your children's health. Excuse me. And that's the first recourse. So when you see a doctor, you use your own savings. When you go to a hospital, the first cost you pay, you pay. But it's scaled, and they have a system which allows them to subsidize various kinds of wards. So you can choose a fully subsidized ward where you pay a smaller fraction, or you can choose a luxury ward where it's not subsidized at all. And it's a very carefully balanced system. And it's balanced between the public and private sector. It's balanced even within the public sector so they compete with each other. Another fundamental concept is price transparency. If you are going to buy, you want to know what you're buying. You want to know how much it costs. Everybody's obliged to publish their prices, whether you're public or private. And you're obliged to give your outcomes. So people can actually shop. I sent this book to a friend recently, and they said, you know, it's amazing you write in this book that you have price and outcome transparency. My daughter just had a child in Singapore, and she went shopping. You go online shopping and figure out who has the best price or the best results. Can you do that here? Not yet. And so those are the sort of some of the lessons, but there's other lessons, some very deep lessons that are not just about health, that are about how you handle retirement, how you handle social structure that are in that system.
So one of the things that many countries are grappling with now is health information technology and how to use technology to improve transparency, track outcomes, and also control costs. In Singapore, how do they use health information technology, both on the delivery side as well as the cost containment?
Well, it would be simpler not to tell the truth, which is to say that they have a uniform system that works perfectly. That isn't the truth at all. In fact, they, like all systems, say they have their legacies. So each of these different systems built their own information system, an electronic health record, et cetera, and they're having their devil's own time getting them all to work together. They're putting a big effort into it. They're rolling it out over to progressive, and I would say 5 years from now, they will have a seamless system. But it'd be a system not in which everybody is forced to use the same electronic record, but one in which all the systems are compatible, public and private. And that's key to what they want to do next. And what they're really interested in doing next is moving the high-quality tertiary care into the home and into the community for the elder population, because that's the way they're hoping that they will be able to control the cost. They started independence with a dependency ratio of 16 people under 65 to 1 over 65. They're now at 6.6. 30 years from now, they'll be at a 2-to-1 ratio. And they're planning for that transition. That means you have to restructure how you do health. In fact, that's the focus of our next book on Singapore, how you do that transition and how you plan for elder care. And as we do that, we'll be studying South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan as well, that are also very well advanced in planning for that.
So could you describe a little bit of the governance system in regard to healthcare in Singapore, in the sense of who makes decisions? Like, what's the relative role of the physician, the patient, and then the role of the policymakers there?
Well, let me start with the role of the policymaker in government. Singapore is also relatively unique in the sense that it has a unified government. It's been in power a long time, the longest government in power, except for the Chinese, the People's Republic, and the decision making is collective and long range, and the ministers work together. And so, when they're planning, for example, when they planned this current healthcare program, and when they are planning now for the next 30 years, there's a ministerial committee that's comprised of the ministers themselves, and then two or three long-term standing committees that draw upon different ministries to integrate what the plans are going to be. That includes housing, finance, transportation, wellness, as well as the Ministry of Health. Now, within a particular, let's take it from the patient point of view. The patient has a problem. He goes to the primary care physician. He may be referred then to the tertiary care physician. They make the diagnosis. And they, like we have diagnostic-related groups. So he'll be assigned that diagnostic-related group. But he can make a choice amongst all the different hospitals which ones he wants to go to. If he's wealthy, he can even go to a private system. And if you look at the statistics in the book, you'll see if he makes that decision, he's going to pay about 3 times as much as he would for the same procedures, with pretty much the same outcome that he would if he went to the public system. So let's say he goes to the public system. He can then make a choice within that public system of which doctors he's going to see or she's going to see, and then the treatment is proceeds. And the outcomes are pretty good for almost everything. It's a few areas where they need improvement, but generally it's good.
And in terms of the cost containment features, obviously that's a huge problem here. How do they control costs? I mean, certainly the price transparency is part of it, and the 401k equivalents.
Yeah.
But what's
this? I have a whole chapter on how they do cost containment. And it's actually, you can't summarize it with one word. It's a very systematic, subtle system. And it's one worth studying because it operates on many different levels. On the one hand, they do make people pay. On the other hand, there is a thought for example, when they had a system, they said, well, we want competition among the various public hospitals, so we'll separately incorporate them and give them incentives to compete. And they thought that would drive prices down. Much to their shock and horror, it drove prices up. Why? Because people started buying expensive equipment and offering higher-end services to get the higher-end paying patients, not the lower-paying patients. So the system intervened and said, okay, we understand what's happened there. We don't like it. So what we're going to do is say, if you want to buy an expensive equipment, a new piece of equipment, we're going to regulate that. If you are going to, we're going to tell you what ratio of wards you have to have, which are the lower paying wards, the ones where we subsidize, which are the upper ones. You can't skew your system so you only have rich people. You have to make sure you serve everybody. So it's a very interesting system of sort of regulated capitalism. Even in their public sector, they have a capitalistic mentality. And that's one of the reasons it works well. But it's not a system that's unregulated by any means. It's highly regulated system. So it's both capitalistic and regulated, something that we here in this country would feel like it's, wearing shorts and a tux, something like that. It's a very odd feeling. But in fact, it works well there.
And, of course, here, one of the things that drives up our healthcare costs is medical tests and the lab tests. And we have duplicate tests. We don't have kind of well-developed electronic health records. So you go to one doctor, there are certain tests. You go to another doctor to get a second opinion. That person wants to do his or her own test. How do they handle it in Singapore?
Well, I can give you testimony that I just twisted my knee and went through the whole process here. And every doctor I saw, I filled out the same forms. You know exactly which ones I'm talking about. And it was all on paper, and it was all totally redundant. And even for all that, these doctors weren't taking my health insurance of any form. They weren't taking Medicare. They weren't taking Medicaid. It was, if you want to see me, pay out of your pocket. So it was not exactly a happy experience. So to ask you a question again.
Medical tests and
health. Yeah, well, there are two issues there. One is, do you pay fee for service or do you pay for the problem you've got? And as you know, that's been a big debate in the United States. Up to now, we've been paying fee for service. So every little thing you do gets charged. So every test you order, you get charged, and the hospital makes some increment on that. And that's a negative incentive in some senses. It's a positive incentive to get you tested completely. It's a negative incentive if you're trying to control costs, and maybe not even very positive for outcome. What we would call bundled service, or you pay for the diagnostic-related group, Singapore is in the advanced state of transferring from a fee-for-service to a DRG payment. The other issue is tort. Is malpractice insurance. The system in Singapore isn't cheap because there's no malpractice. In fact, they have malpractice suits like we do. Their malpractice insurance for doctors is not anywhere near what ours is, but as you'll see from some of the charts, it's rising substantially. So they have a system where if you believe you've been wronged, you can sue. But as people are now moving less away, less toward fee-for-service and more for bundle payments, it seems to work pretty well.
Tell me about the public response of the average Singaporean to their healthcare system. What do they like? What don't they like about it?
In general, they really like it. And there's two sorts of surveys that have been done. One is, do you like your healthcare service? Is it doing what you want? And there it's running about 70, 75% positive. The next question you ask them is, do you recommend this for other people? And the answer is generally yes. Almost everybody will recommend the system to someone else. Where are the rough edges? The rough edges are where you get to elder care and chronic disease, where you have long-term high-cost expenses. Because one of the things the Singaporean system does is ask you, no matter what it is, to pay 20% of the cost. And you can imagine if you're paying 20% of the cost of, say, long-term diabetes treatment, or renal transfusion, that can be very high. Now, it never bankrupts them. The bankruptcy rate there for medical causes is virtually zero. And the reason for that is they have two other layers of protection. One of the most fundamental layers of protection they have is a near universal catastrophic health insurance. There's deductibles, there's co-pays with that. For the young people here in the audience under, say, 35, they'd be paying $30 a year. For an older guy like me, I'd be paying $150, $200 a year. I can buy higher protection than that. But on average, they pay 2% healthcare insurance costs to what we pay. And so with that, and with another provision, which is called Medifund, which will protect the indigent, virtually nobody goes bankrupt. I have a couple of case studies of going through some hospital bills. And if you go through those, you'll see exactly how an individual who's wealthy and individuals who's middle income or poor can manage very costly experience. But the edges where people are a little unhappy are elder care. The families are supporting. They can use their own. They can use everybody else's funds, but it does get costly for them. The result of that is a new program they called Elder Shield and a way of protecting the elderly. Also, Singapore runs a government surplus of about $10 billion. I was thinking that's probably about in our terms, would be about a $400 billion a year plus surplus that they run, and they've run for quite a while. They use that money to top up people's accounts. So recently there was unhappiness about the elder care payments. They're actually now paying people a certain amount of money per year if you're elderly to get yourself taken care of. Also, by the way, they have a fertility problem, so they get very big supplements for the third, fourth, and if you are up for a fifth child, they will really pay you a lot.
Just out of curiosity.
Not working, by the way.
Just out of curiosity, what's the going rate for the extra child?
I think it's about 18,000. Mm-hmm. For the fifth or more.
And that goes a long way in Singapore.
Yeah, it does. Yes. It's good.
Okay.
Anywhere goes a long way.
What about the lessons for the United States? I mean, you did say Singapore has many unique elements, but if you were...
Right. We're not saying the United States should be Singapore. We are a big country. But one of the things that I was at the board meeting, Daryl, that I found really interesting was your city and local and city initiative and Bruce Katz's work. Basically, he's saying, don't think of America. Think of America as, what, 50 cities? Our economic units of production of cities. The central government's not working all that well. You've got to focus on the cities, have city-to-city relationships, have city-to-foreign-city relationship. And if you look at America as a collection of cities, we can manage the way, we can take some real lessons from Singapore. And it's curious that that's the way Singapore, looks at the world, looks at China, looks at other countries. Yes, we can't give the answers to an entire country, but we can certainly help you with some issues, some city issues. But very specifically, I would say there are three or four lessons for us. The first that I've mentioned is co-payment. That's not foreign to us. We all co-pay. But the argument would be we don't co-pay enough. Co-pay as much as you can afford. I don't know what that number is, but it's more than I'm asked to co-pay, and it should be, in my view, means adjusted. So substantial co-pays all the way through the system, nothing for free. High deductibles, co-pay, but make it possible for people who can't pay to have service. The second thing that we've also discussed is transparency. There's a bunch of articles that have come out about price inequities. Steve Brill wrote this major piece for Time magazine that many of you may have seen. If you haven't, I recommend it. It talks about hospital pricing. If there's anything that's opaque and transparent, actually, there's going to be a new word for Byzantine. It's going to be hospital pricing. It is really an amazing process, and they don't even know themselves what they're charging. And there are big businesses that are set up just to take hospital bills and negotiate with insurance costs and work on the margins. It's a really complicated system, and it's not a fair system because you really don't know what you're being charge for, how much you're going to have to pay, and you don't know what the outcome. So outcomes transparency. I think in this country, competition, but managed competition, will work. If you have unrestrained competition, you're likely to get what we had at some points where people are trying to cherry pick. But regulated competition where you have large groups that compete on cost and outcome, not only for the whole system, but on individual doctors, I think is a really important feature. And then as we plan for our future, because we are aging also, transiting from a tertiary hospital-based system to one which is a local, a in-home, and a community-based system are also really important features. Something that won't make me popular among my doctor friends is doctors on salaries. So they're not incentivized as piecework, but they work on a salary so they can devote more time to their patients, and they aren't so frantic. I think all those things are lessons that we can learn that we can incorporate. Also, I would say there should be room, as there is in Singapore, for an entirely private system. If people want to opt out of a public-private system, they should be free to do so. And so I think those are important lessons.
Okay.
There's one other lesson. Singapore is now saying, our cost basis may be too high. We're surrounded by a lower-cost neighborhood, Malaysia, Indonesia. We're starting to experiment to letting our citizens go to Malaysia. We have to certify that Malaysian hospital, but if we do, our citizens can use our Singaporean dollars there and maybe in Indonesia. That's to put price pressure on the system. I would be happy to see that work for Canada, for Mexico, for the Caribbean, for some of our neighbors too.
So one more question in the United States, then I'm going to open the floor to questions and comments from the audience. So recently in the United States, we've had a lot of changes, the Affordable Care Act, noticeable among them. Are the changes that we are seeing now moving U.S. healthcare in the right direction based on what you've learned, not just in Singapore, but other nations around the world, or not moving us in the right direction?
I think they're moving us slightly in the right direction. It's hard to move a system that is $2.8 trillion a year, that is as big and complex as ours is. But I think it's doing a couple of fundamental things. I urge those who have been inundated by Fox News and other Obamacare opponents to go onto Wikipedia and look at some of what the provisions of the Affordable Health Care Act are. And I would challenge most of you to find something wrong with those. Is there something wrong with saying that you can't exclude people on the basis of a pre-existing condition? And there's a whole series of provisions that are, I think, moving people in the right direction. There is an attempt to control cost, but even by their own projections, over a 20-year period, it's a 10%. So that moves us from something like a $5 trillion expense to a $4.5 to $4.7 trillion expense. That's still a heck of a lot of money, and I think that we can shave $1 or $2 trillion off that if we institute these kinds of programs and have better health care than we have today. So the answer is it's making some incremental changes. It's moving more people into the system, but its primary thrust is not to control cost, although it will control some costs. And one of the most important things they're doing is trying to work on bundled payments and some transparency.
Okay. Why don't we open the floor to questions?
And please say who you are. So,
yeah, give us your name and if you're with an organization.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. I have absolutely no trouble with physicians on salary, provided that there aren't onerous productivity requirements that go with that. The one thing you haven't mentioned is private insurance. The ACA is based on competition between private insurers with different benefit plans. Now, it sounds like in Singapore there's a uniform benefit plan that covers everybody, everything.
There are several different layers of insurance in Singapore. But there are like six major providers. They are required to have some basic similarities and basic coverage, so you can't provide. There's a whole series of things you have to do. But on top of that, you can add other things. So it's not uniform. And there's a completely private sector you can use too. So you can use the public insurance. This Medifund is much more highly regulated than completely private insurance. But all the insurance have certain things you have to cover.
And the prices?
And the prices...
all different?
I don't know the answer to. That's a good question I have to look at. I suspect the prices are pretty comparable in the Medi Fund and not comparable in the private.
That's a big difference.
Yeah.
We have a question.
Gordon Johnson. I'm a retired businessman. In the past, 80% of our people worked in agriculture, and we've celebrated how we produce with 4% of our people. Manufacturing absorbed all our employment, and we celebrate how we've really made manufacturing productive. How did we get ourselves in a position where healthcare is not being celebrated as a growth industry or a growth place for exciting place for young people to go? Instead, it's a place that costs too much. How did we get in that situation?
Well, it's a regardless of how we got there, the fact is it's been the only source of steady employment growth in the country for a long time. And that's one of, I'll give you a very direct conversation. I was discussing with Tremonti, who was then Deputy Prime Minister of Italy, some of these ideas. He said, Bill, I really understand that, and I think we can get a lot more efficient. But let me tell you a political reality, being a politician. The only source of job growth we've had in Italy for the last 30 years is in healthcare services. And you're telling me to cut jobs? You think I'll last as a politician if I cut jobs? And that's one of our problems here, too. It's the whole issue of where are there jobs in our society. So there are jobs in healthcare, and there are jobs in healthcare services. And I actually called the lobby which put this system in place, maybe not an attractive name, but I call it the dirt lobby because it's deeper than grass. The lobby for healthcare services is in every tiny community. You try to cut an ambulance service. You try to consolidate ambulance services for a region. You try to make a hospital system in a region more efficient. So rather than having three or four, you have one. Almost impossible, because that is the jobs. So part of our problem is the one you've mentioned, general productivity and where is America productive. But, you know, there's a lot of issues that have to do with... We had a very interesting discussion also on income disparities. And a big part of income disparity, and that is the American working man and woman, have not increased substantially. In fact, there's some arguments they've decreased in their income over time. A big chunk of that is because it's being sucked away. Productivity gains are being sucked away by high healthcare costs. They're just draining out a big chunk of income that otherwise could have gone to increasing salaries. So it's a very interrelated problem for what the issues are with both employment, productivity, and healthcare costs. A knotty problem, but it doesn't mean it's insoluble.
Okay, back there is a young woman with her hand up. Yeah, there's a microphone coming over to you.
Hi, my name is Emily Latimer. I'm interning at the office of Senator Brian Schatz. A lot of European countries have contained costs by implementing no public funding for expensive end-of-life care. Does Singapore do anything like this in terms of limiting services and public funding for end-of-life services?
Not directly. They don't. And let me say, when I started working in this area, my basic thought was America can go on two courses. There's no doubt that we're going to contain costs. And I think we're about the maximum. We may go up to 20% of GDP. But no part of every aspect of our society is going to push back. Whether it's the military, whether it's Social Security, whether it's education, whether it's our businesses, we're not going to afford more than 20%, I think. And so how are we going to react to that? Are we going to restrict services? Are we going to degrade the services we offer, or are we going to get more efficient? And how do we get more efficient? Do we just look at ourselves and think how to get more efficient, or should we go out and look at the rest of the world and see what they're doing? And the argument I would make is, sure, we have to look internally, we have to think ourselves, but we should look around the world. And I was told, and it still may be true, there's not been a single congressional delegation that's ever gone abroad to look at a healthcare system. I don't know if that's still true. You might know the answer to that. Maybe you'll organize the next one. We'll be happy to help you.
Tell your boss that. Okay. Gentleman here on the aisle, there's a question.
Yes, Joshua Schoen, Peterson Institute. As NPR recently reported, disability insurance is largely becoming another pillar to Social Security. Do we see the same problems in Singapore? And how do we reform that system when essentially the labor market doesn't have the skills to compete? And we need a means to support the people that don't have an education.
Right. I don't think it's a serious problem in Singapore, disability payments. It certainly hasn't appeared on my radar, although I can't give you a specific, only to say I never saw it as a serious issue that we encountered. But there is a particular take I have on a whole range of issues that cost us a lot. And that is, we are by and large moved away from a system of collective bargaining and collective action toward individual action and individual responsibility. And that's a whole trend in American life. The consequence of that is individuals still need protection, and our courts are substituting for collective action. And the way you can look at it is you can pay Peter or you can pay Paul. You either pay the union or you pay disability. You know, as an employer, I can tell you I never fired a single person without a lawsuit, no matter how justified that firing might have been. We were always sued for discrimination, for one thing or another, or disability. And so that's a price we pay for the lifestyle we've chosen. It's not particularly attractive, and it can get out of control, as we've seen.
Gentleman over here next to the wall, what's the question?
Hi, my name is Stephen Chivoni. I'm a student at American University. You talked about managed competition, and there was kind of an attempt to do that in America with the New Deal. And I was just wondering, in terms of politics and implementation, what lessons can be applied from this in healthcare reform, from what you've learned in Singapore?
Well, let's just take the public sector, where they have a private sector which is free to compete. There are certain ground rules, things they have to do, but they're much more freer to price and compete than the public sector. Well, the first thing they did in the public sector is they broke it up into each hospital group is an independent corporation. And they get some funds for the government. And if they are inefficient, they can save those funds. They have some direction as to how they can invest those funds, but they can actually save money and invest it. They don't make profit from it, but they can pay their doctors more, they can buy more equipment, they can improve their infrastructure, and they can do research with monies they've saved. They found with unrestricted competition that the prices actually went up because of what I mentioned before. People are trying to compete at the highest end of the market, and that drove up the price altogether. So then they put in some other regulated controls. And I think the way I see, I think, you know, one of the things we do really well is have big groups compete with one another. I mean, think of what our auto industry was like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and look what it is today. We have adjusted, we understand, we have a flexible job system, we have a flexible management system, we are aggressive and capable of creating effective lean systems if we have to. And I think that's the kind of strength we have to draw on here for our healthcare systems. I don't think we should have a public system. I don't think that's a fully public system. That's not a system that works very well in this context. But a system in which you allow the private systems to compete with each other, but in a regulated way, I think can work.
On the aisle is a young man who has a question.
Thanks. I'm Jeffrey Lin from Senator Angus King's office, and my question is, going about Singapore, how much of the public sector, healthcare sector in Singapore would have access to the latest, well, I mean, or the most current healthcare technology as opposed to compared to the private sector, that is?
I would say, it's, as far as I can judge, it's virtually equal. That the quality of healthcare service in the public hospitals is about as good as you get anywhere in the world. They are extremely well-trained doctors. They import them and train them from all over the world. They've actually, there's one point I will mention about that, though. So they have very good equipment. And I don't think that the private hospitals offer any better medicine than the public hospitals. They do offer better amenities. So they'll have bigger rooms. You'll have more solicitous care. I don't think you'll have better care. And in fact, one of the tensions that's arisen in Singapore is medical tourism. The medical tourists are preferring the public to the private hospitals. And that's a tension in Singapore because they're paying more for the public hospitals than they are for the private hospitals. And it was okay as long as they were Malaysians and Indonesians because they couldn't tell the difference. But now when it's a Saudi, they can tell the difference. And there's been some political trouble over that. So they're thinking about limiting the amount of medical tourism that can take place in their public hospitals. But that's a measure of how good people judge the public versus the private to be, and that's why I gave that answer. There's another way that they've been thinking about controlling costs, and that is controlling the number of doctors. Their belief has been, and I don't know if it still is, but certainly in the early days, that if there's an oversupply of doctors, they will raise the cost because people will start trying to do things that aren't necessary. There'll be too many doctors competing. And so they've regulated the number of doctors that can be there. There's enough doctors to take care of people, but they don't want an oversupply. And that's sort of an oddity of their system.
Okay, in the very back, there's a man with a question.
Hi, I'm Randy Sim. How does Singapore pay for brand name drugs and, in particular, very expensive drugs? Is there any rationing or what?
There is a drug formulary, and they say these are going to be the approved drugs in the public system. They generally pay for most of the drugs you would have in the United States. I've talked to drug company executives who are unhappy with some of their policies. They call them non-transparent. There was a political issue in the last election over the drug formulary where there's it's been claimed that it's not as transparent as it should be, how they make decisions, what should be and shouldn't be included. So it's not a completely transparent system, but it's not one that's as brutal as the British system for cancer drugs, expensive cancer drugs, for example, or MS drugs or migraine headache drugs, for example. The British system is a much tougher system in terms of what they call cost-benefit analysis through NICE. So it's a more generous system, but it's not a completely unregulated system. They do have a formulary, and the processes by which they arrive at that are not as transparent as some people in Singapore would like. They do negotiate the prices, but they generally don't. They generally use market prices. It's not a major competitive advantage in the Singapore system. They do buy in bulk, but it's basically at market rates. They don't have. It's not like India or other countries where, or it's not even like Japan, or Taiwan or Korea where drug prices are set by the government. They're not set by the government.
Okay, we have a question right here.
In our country, we are hearing that we are going to be running up against serious problems in the education of medical students. The number of students who will go, who will agree to stay in the medical service, where they can get their residencies, and so on, in light of savings that are being made. Would you tell us, in Singapore, are there adequate medical students coming through the line, quantity and quality, and how are they paid for?
In terms of the medical education in Singapore is truly excellent. They produce very, very high-quality doctors. They've had a traditional medical school, a European-style undergraduate medical education school. They recently started 6 years ago, Duke and U.S. In my opinion, I spent a lot of time with them and their dean. They're the most innovative, best medical school in the world, the Duke and U.S. school, and it's paid for by Singapore. The students are paid for by Singapore. You don't pay yourself. And they're not only from Singapore either. Although if they're not from Singapore, they're required to be in Singapore for 5-6 years afterwards to continue to work there. And now they're building a third medical school with a research arm at their technical university with MIT. It's not only a good medical school, they've completely revised and revamped a university education system. So they've got a whole system for education. The students come in with lower scores at the Duke NUS system and end up after the first year outperforming all the Duke students substantially. And if you're interested, I can talk about medical education and education reform. But it's a really interesting system, and it produces really good doctors. That doesn't mean that in terms of the U.S., are we producing enough doctors? I think what's happening is a major demographic shift. And what you're having is people who are going into medicine today are not going in not only to make money. There are a lot of people who went into medicine years ago because it was going to be a very highly respected and a high-paying job. Anybody who's gone through medical school understands that that's a very poor reason to go to medical school. It's a hell of a lot of work. And if you go to Wall Street or something, it's where you should go if you want to really make money, not to become a doctor. But be that as it may, we're going through a transformation where the expectations of the doctors are they're not going to be as wealthy as they were. I think that's probably correct. And it's shifting. It's shifting demographically. There are many more women and many more minorities that are upwardly mobile minorities that are in the medical schools today than there were before. I don't think there'll be a shortage of doctors. It's just going to be a different makeup.
So in your book, you mentioned women's health as something that is taken very seriously in Singapore. So what are they doing in particular?
Well, they've had an emphasis from very early on maternal child care. And if you look at the maternal child mortality statistics, that's one of the most shocking things if you look around the world at inequities. The U.S. is not doing well in terms of maternal mortality and mortality under one and mortality under five. We are below every OECD nation, and we can't even see the bottom of the OECD statistics from where we are. We're down below, I think, Santo Domingo or Dominican Republic. We are not doing well in a very, very important part. And that's true for mortality of adults under the age, I say between the ages of 25 and 65. We're not doing very well. So in terms of their focus on the mother and child, they were focused very early on in maternal child care, and they still are. They have some of the best statistics in the world on maternal child care.
But what are they doing to produce those good numbers?
They have a whole series of clinics that are specially designed for health and wellness of mothers and newborns. And they've had them for a very long time. Let me say the other thing that they have is they have a ministry of wellness. Which is, that means, and they have a whole month of wellness awareness. It's not just a ministry. They have a ministry of health, but they have a ministry of wellness, which means exercise, good life, clean living, et cetera. So they have a whole a very high emphasis on that. And a lot of that is on child health.
Americans would never stand for that.
A ministry of wellness, no. That sounds Orwellian, it's true.
Yes. This gentleman right here has a question.
Hi, Doctor. My name is Neil Condamori, and I go to Duke. My question is...
And so you're one of those students who are being outperformed.
Yeah, I know. If only I was in Singapore. So I'm really curious about price transparency, actually. A lot of states in the U.S. right now are patting themselves on the back for providing ChargeMaster data, which really isn't much of what patients are actually paying. So I'm interested in, I guess I have two questions about the Singapore system. One would be that a big dilemma right now with providing prices in America is that people are worried that the highest price, that people will automatically assume that the highest price option is also associated with the highest quality option. So do you actually see prices rising in Singapore because of that? And then the second sort of tangential question to that, is quality and price paired?
I think you have to pair quality and price. And people do. The example I gave you is a very specific example. And as part of the interview process, there were about five of us interviewing lots of people. I conducted a number of the interviews, but we also had other people. And we interviewed a lot of people, just average people that we would encounter. They are very much aware of the price quality comparisons, and so they actually do shop for the what they think is going to be the best price for the outcome, and it hasn't caused price inflation at this point. And I think that it hasn't, as far as I can see. Doesn't mean they wouldn't here.
Okay, right here we have a question.
Hi, Arturo Brunenburg. Can you tell us a little bit what they're thinking about in terms of the genetic, creating a genetic database for the population?
I haven't heard a systematic discussion of that. Insofar as they're considering what they're doing, it's with their electronic health record. I don't believe at this point they're going to match that to genetics. That doesn't mean that they won't. It just means that I haven't heard about it. There are people who are doing it. It's an interesting question. Are you going to do some places, say, for some of the Scandinavian countries, not only have a complete record of people's history, but they're now doing major chunks of genetic analysis. There's also, I'll leave it at that. As some of you may know, I'm also a genomicist by background. And I just was pleased to see that there's a new exhibit at the National History Museum on genomics. It opens tomorrow.
Cool. Yeah, if I could ask a follow-up on that, just given your interest in and expertise on genomics, is Singapore doing much on personalized medicine where they, you know, kind of read somebody's gene and see what drugs are particularly appropriate for them?
The answer is yes, but that's only part of their modernization. Part of modern medicine is to try to make sure that you're getting the drug you should be getting. And let me say, for the most part, it doesn't depend on who you are. It depends on what you've got. And the biggest advances in genomics don't depend on who you are as a human being. They depend on what disease you've got. So cancer, turns out, is many diseases has been defined. Let's say it's a head and neck cancer. Let's take a very famous example, maybe now infamous example, throat cancer. Everybody probably read about Michael Douglas's throat cancer. Well, before Michael Douglas, or say 10, 15 years ago, everybody defined throat cancer as one or two kinds of diseases. Well, it turns out the most common form of head, half of head and neck cancer is caused by a virus and needs to be treated differently. By the way, it's better if it's caused by a virus than not. It's more treatable. And that says this class of people you treat this way, this class you should try a bunch of things and see what works best. That's the kind of differential diagnosis that genomics allows, proteomics allows, that it really didn't do before. It's a very minor thread is what are your inborn differences that allow you to react to drugs differently. That's a minor theme compared to this major theme of what do you really have and what can we treat. Just like with a bacterial infection. Now they're doing it for many, many other diseases. And Singapore is incorporating that form. They're not doing predictive medicine. And I would say we're 20 or 30 years away at least from good predictive medicine, letting you know. I think we'll get there. Be able to say, you, Daryl, 5 years from now, you're going to get this. 15 years, you're going to go for that. And no plan to do anything 20 years from now.
Actually, I don't anyway.
That's not specific, by the way, to Daryl.
Okay. There's a woman back there. Actually, two of you. We'll get questions from each of you.
Hello, Erin Boyle from the Association of American Medical Colleges. You mentioned that the rough edges of those who are dissatisfied with Singapore's system include the chronically ill, and that's largely due to the fact that they have so much skin in the game and have to pay so much for their care. Is Singapore doing anything to address that problem outside of catastrophic insurance?
Yes, they are. They have I mentioned Elder Shield and special programs where they supplement the income of the elderly, so their accounts, their retirement accounts, from governmental surplus. In terms of diabetes and kidney disease, there are special programs that help people with those. So they respond to those perceived needs with programs that are specifically targeted to those populations that need more help. So the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Okay, right in front of you is another question. Okay, we'll take a question.
And actually, in several of these chapters, let me just say, this is a book. You can buy it, of course. We want you to buy it. It goes to, the profits go to Brookings, and any ones that come to me go to the foundation. However, it is a free ebook. And if you go to www.accessh.org, it's a free PDF. And while you're at that site, you can read a little bit about our foundation. But we wanted this book to be distributed as widely as possible. That's why it's a free PDF, so you can send it to all your friends for free. Okay, and we've distributed it widely around the world as a free PDF for that point. But we do encourage you to buy it, and if you do buy it, I'll sign it. I cannot sign your PDF.
Okay, back there.
I'm Sarah Sonies, and I'm with the Association of American Medical Colleges as well. And just going back to the issue of transparency and the chargemaster, my question is that you were saying that patients can essentially online comparison shop for different prices of treatments and procedures in each hospital. But the issue in the United States is when consumers often do that, what the prices of the procedures are aren't always what they end up costing in the long term. And I was wondering if this is something that's also an issue in Singapore, and if so, how they're dealing with it, or if it's not, how do they keep a minimal discrepancy between price and actual cost?
I don't know the answer. It's a very good question. It's something that we should look into more. I don't know the answer. I mean, that's certainly true here. I suspect there the cost that is posted is pretty much the real cost. And if there's a discrepancy, people are going to have to correct it because the government pays a lot of attention to those kinds of things. But I don't know the specific answer to that.
Okay, this young lady has a question. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, I'm Rita. I'm an intern at AEI. I'm curious about your suggestion that U.S. citizens go to Canada or Mexico for medical care. Do you envision that relationship being reciprocal, which seems somewhat problematic, or how would that system work?
Well, it's up to those countries to make it reciprocal, but it would be okay. I don't see why it shouldn't be okay. I think a number of countries and insurance programs are allowing medical tourism to reduce their own cost. So they're paying for people to go to France, for example, for operations they can't have here, to go to other places to have operations at a lower cost. And so private systems that want to reduce their costs are allowing some of their patients to go overseas. I think you have to be very careful with that. You have to make sure that you know what the quality. So when Singapore does it, they inspect those hospitals. In fact, I believe that probably the hospitals the Singaporeans allow, in Malaysia, allow Singaporeans to go to are owned by Singaporeans.
So in other words, be careful where you get your new kidney. Right there.
Hi, my name is Anna Giulio. My question's a little bit different about Medicare fraud. It's one of the few bipartisan things that exists, or problems to solve, I guess. Estimates are really high, from $50 billion a year to $100 billion a year. Does Singapore have a problem with Medicare fraud or fraud in their public system? And if so, how do they fix it? And could that solution be brought to the United States?
I had a very wise boss who once told me, when I was horrified at some scientist who cheated and was caught out, he said, Bill, in every profession there are crooks. Part of human nature. There are priests that are crooks. There are doctors who are crooks, scientists, businessmen, they're crooks, and you have to protect yourself against them. And so Singapore is no different from any other place. There are people who try to cheat. But if you get caught, I wouldn't like to be caught in Singapore. And they have deterrents that are more credible and more swift than ours.
In the very back, there's a question.
Hi, my name is Vidal Sigope, and I'm from the advisory board. And I was wondering about the investments that are being made in the transition towards the community, as you mentioned before, tertiary care migrating to the community. I was wondering, what are those investments and who is making those investments?
The investments are, first of all, there's a systematic investment in the They've reorganized the healthcare system, so there's six major public systems, and those integrate into a whole hub and spoke with secondary, primary, and community and home care. And so their idea is it's the tertiary hospital that should guarantee the quality, and that should be done through telehealth and electronic health records. So you should have the quality driven from the center. And if you need to move in toward the tertiary hospital, you should be able to do so. But you should do so with a guaranteed quality. That cost is being borne by the central government, as they bear most of the costs for the public infrastructure. They don't bear the operating costs, but they've borne most of the costs of creating the infrastructure, and that's what they're doing now. For example, they're really considering how you build new housing projects. They have incentives for children to live close to parents. They have new housing projects that have clinics and small hospital wards built into them. They are rethinking how they move people around, what the transportation network is going to look like. They're rethinking all of their building codes so that people with disabilities can get around even more easily than they can today. So there's a very systematic effort, but that is being done and planned governmentally. Let me give you another example of their activities. We as a foundation were involved a little bit with this. They've created a new school of public health. But you say, well, what is Singapore doing with school of public health when it's addressed most of its fundamental health issues? That school of public health is actually devoted to looking at alternatives for the elder and chronically ill. And it's interested in doing the fundamental research and gathering the information of what you can do and then doing sophisticated modeling of what the implications in terms of cost-benefit are. But on a whole integrated basis, not just on a health basis, if you restructure a housing plan, what are the cost benefits for that? What are the health benefits? What are the other costs of that? So they've created a whole new idea for what a school of public health should be. There are some traditional aspects because they're going to serve the region in general, but their primary mission is a Singaporean-based mission to look ahead to make sure that they can deliver high quality at a cost that they can sustain. Let me say, if you're in Singapore, you have a really big incentive to control your costs. Because you have, although most people don't realize it, the primary directive for Singapore is defend yourself against your big neighbors. They have a military that's not unlike Israel's. It's a very powerful, focused military, and the regional neighbors know it. And if you listen to their founders, they built their economic strength so that they could be militarily strong. The second, of course, is economic strength. And so they look at every aspect of what they do in terms of survival in a very complicated environment. And so when they're thinking about healthcare costs, they have an urgency which we might not have ourselves. There's a survival urgency to give good care, but give it at a cost that's sustainable over a very long period of time, given the transitions that they're going through demographically. And that's why they're willing to put, you know, I was recently in Singapore and listened to their prime minister talk, and he understands they're probably going to have to spend somewhat more than they've spent now, but not a whole lot more. He was their defense minister for a while as well.
Okay, I think we will end it on that note. But, Bill, thank you very much. This is very interesting. If you want a copy of the book, you can pick up a copy, i.e. buy a copy, right outside the auditorium. So, Thank you very much.
Great job. Thank you.